Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT every weekday, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they are broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content, as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. That's also where you can support my various musical and non-musical efforts at Popular Education. Today's guest is a co-director of popularresistance.org. The associated Facebook page is also the most popular platform for my live stream broadcasts since I started doing them in April. Kevin Zeese is an attorney as well as an organizer, popular educator, author, blogger, and host of the weekly podcast Clearing the Fog. He's been a principal organizer of many different endeavors, from the recent invited occupation of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., to the Occupy Wall Street encampment at Freedom Plaza, to some of the earlier campaigns for drug legalization and against mass incarceration in the United States. He's also currently the press secretary of Howie Hawkins' campaign for president, Green Party campaign for president of the United States. Kevin Zeese, welcome to my little live stream show.
Thanks for having me on, David. I love you doing it. It's a great project for you.
It's keeping me busy and and relatively comparatively sane under the circumstances. There's so much going on that it's like if I don't have a daily hour-long discussion with somebody who's on top of what's happening, I feel even more lost, even as a 24-hour news junkie. And I woke up this morning at 5 a.m. I always wake up on the hour to hear the headlines, like automatic. It's not I don't have an alarm. It's just in my head. And the headline was about the police moving into the CHOP in Seattle. I assume you saw that, too. Maybe start with any thoughts you have on that particular recent development, which is only one of many earth-shattering developments of the past few hours. But
well, you know, it was interesting that the timing of going after the CHOP also was timed with the going after the occupation of City Hall in New York City, which was similar to CHOP. Both were, you know, these movements are so interesting.
Watching the police are moving into New York City, and that's not even in the news at all. Well, is that right? Is that happening?
Well, it happened actually yesterday morning. You know, there's been...
I'm so behind the times.
That was an amazing occupation in Canton, too. Just like...
Right.
I mean, it was thousands of people, and they had tents, and they were libraries and tea houses, and, you know, it's just like... this is Occupy Revisited. And it's always so interesting to watch movements evolve. You know, I think it's... movements move, and they transform. And they go through different iterations, and especially when a movement is really developing into a movement, it's got multiple leaders. There's no one person, no one group in charge. It's filled with leadership, and that's what creates the surprise developments. And so I have no doubt that the people in Seattle, in New York, will evolve as well. And we'll take another action that will surprise the power structure. And that's why you want to have diverse leadership, because one of the powers of movements is unpredictability. And, you know, this time is so interesting with, you know, we get all the attention to the very important uprising reaction to the Floyd murder and police violence. Very amazing uprising. But at the same time that's happening, since the Floyd protest started, there have been 650 wildcat strikes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's yeah, one of
rent, all the rent strike stuff going. It's just like there's so many different aspects of this. It's a fantastic time.
It's kind of like it started before the George Floyd killing and the uprising that immediately followed it. There was already, as you say, all these rent strikes and all these wildcat strikes, and then since the George Floyd killing and since this movement that's developing, it's also like taking on so many different what they would call in the corporate press issues, but really it's all about this totally interconnected. Massive interconnected question of the police, the military, the prisons, the everything. I mean, it
really adds roots about neoliberal capitalism.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. That's what's really there.
The police are there to enforce the social order, the economic order. In Baltimore, where I live, we have what's called the White L going down the center of Baltimore and along the coast of the waterfront. And on the black butterflies on the east and west part of Baltimore, hyper segregated city. It was the first city to have redlining, and the police job is to keep the butterflies out of the L.
Mm.
And so they're the enforcement mechanism for abuse of capitalism when these communities that in those butterfly areas, 40,000 abandoned houses, 40,000. And it's areas of neglect. And rather than creating a fair economy with decent jobs and building up around the black college, we have a couple black colleges in town that really could be economic powerhouses for those communities. Rather than building those up, they put money into police. So police have a bigger budget than our health budget, than our education budget. This is like typical, U.S. urban crisis. Rather than spending money to uplift communities, we spend money to keep them down.
And not just because you're the press secretary for Howie Hawkins' campaign, but just because this is reality and this is America, I have to say that to note that Baltimore and Washington, D.C. and most of the cities, I believe it's accurate to say the vast majority of the cities in this country, which have these police budgets at 40-50% of the budget, these are cities that are completely stranglehold controlled by the Democratic Party.
That's exactly right. And that's one reason why I rejected the Democrats in the 90s during Clinton. He was NAFTA, the drug war. He put a general in charge of the drug war. You have a health problem, so put a general in charge. I mean, come here, he destroyed the safety net programs. He lost me there. And I was, in this century, I got more involved in third party politics. I was Ralph Nader's press secretary. And I worked on Jill Stein's campaign. So, I see this long history of the Democrats. And when you're in Maryland, you're in an uber blue state, not just the city. We have not had a non-Democrat in the city council or in mayor for more than 50 years.
Yep.
50 years.
And that's typical of so many places. It's like that here in Portland, up in Seattle. I mean, except they have a wonderful socialist on the city council in Seattle. But that's
Well, they the same thing in Chicago. They got some socialists on that city council too. Mm. What I love about Chicago these days, I think that's the most important issue that's not getting enough focus, is democratic community control of the police. This is a signature issue. If you want to really learn about it, go to HowieHawkins.us. He has a great position statement on democratic community control of police. But what that means is neighborhoods decide who polices their neighborhood and how they police their neighborhood. Neighborhoods decide the training of police, the budget of police, the union contracts get reviewed. They can hire and fire. They can call grand jury investigation when police look like they've committed crimes. Community control of police is the issue we should be focused on, more than important than defund the police. Because we can see, I'm in favor of defunding, I'm in favor of shifting budgets and building up social programs, social workers, mental health professionals, public health administrators, also, build up lots of the things that are being neglected and take that money from these abusive police budgets. But we have to change the power dynamic. We have to put the people in charge. Right now, the police themselves, these civilian review boards, often the police chief picks who's on them. No, we need democratic community control of police. And I think that Chicago, the organizers in Chicago working on this are doing an incredible job. They've got more than half the city's aldermen supporting it. They're working toward a veto-proof majority for democratic community control. And that would mean neighborhoods elect a board that decides how their neighborhoods are policed. That's how it should be. And so this is a long-term issue. It goes back to the Black Panthers.
And it's extremely challenging to the whole system of capitalism, because, like, just to take one fairly prominent example in the current climate with, I believe, in at least I was hearing just the other day that in the state of Florida, I think one out of three renters did not pay the rent last month. It's just, and it's similar statistics in many other states. What if a local community voted that forced evictions were not something that police could engage in? I assume that would be easy enough for people to vote on, because there's a lot of communities where most everybody in a poor neighborhood are renters. And then what would the police do?
David, the rent strike, of course, we have a housing crisis. 32% nationwide renters didn't make their rent payment.
32% did not pay rent.
28% didn't pay their mortgage.
Until right.
And it's in the middle of the month. Maybe they can pay it then. But so you have a housing crisis.
Yeah.
In this country, and we need a nationalized housing program. You know, one of the great things about Venezuela is that they, even during this, we're very involved in Venezuela because we had a year ago I was in the Venezuelan embassy with other activists protecting it from a coup. So we've monitored Venezuela and visited a couple times in the last few years. But one thing they're doing is a social housing program. Even with this economic war in the United States, they've built more than 3 million social housing units for a population of 32 million people. 3 million housing units, 4 people, that's 12 million people out of 32 million get free housing.
It's astounding. And of course, it's never mentioned.
United States, with more than 300 million people, has 1 million public housing units, and they're being privatized. And so what a comparison.
What a comparison. And then also just the social democracies of Europe. You go around there and you see it's a public housing, one building after the next, and you ask who owns it, who built it, the government.
What's interesting about the European model, the social, and they call it social housing rather than public housing, but the social housing in some of these in the European cities is not just for the poor.
No, and you'd never know who isn't. You would absolutely have no idea in Copenhagen what's government housing and what is private.
And it's for the middle class, working class, it's subsidized, and so people can afford to live decently, and that's just essential, And it's not just housing, basic necessities. United States healthcare, total mess. We have on the popular resistance, in addition to covering the news on popular resistance, the movement news and movement news issues, we also have projects, campaigns. One of them is Health Over Profit for Everyone. It's a movement for improved Medicare for all. And you can go to popularresistance.org and click on the Hope campaign and get involved in that. But healthcare is another necessity that's ignored. Food. What's the poverty in the United States? I mean, it's tens of millions of people going to bed hungry every night.
Even on Marketplace on NPR, and I mean, I'm sure you're listening to the corporate media as much as I am as well, and they are, the narrative is changing so much. And on Marketplace yesterday, they actually admitted, one of the guests actually admitted, most Americans were living paycheck to paycheck before the pandemic, and then the paycheck stopped. And that's on Marketplace.
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting today on Popular Resistance. We're publishing an article from Bloomberg. I don't think we've ever done this before. And it's an article about how the United States, if it's the trajectory the United States is on, when you look at issues like healthcare and housing and food and incomes and wealth divide, we're on a trajectory in the next before the century is finished of being a poor developing nation. And this is in Bloomberg. I mean, so yeah, it's getting so bad that everyone can see it. And, just today, France said they're not going to participate in the next naval exercise.
NATO.
Yeah, and Germany doesn't want U.S. troops. They're putting U.S. troops are leaving Germany, and you know, so there's all sorts of interesting changes going on where the United and you know, and then of course you have Iran indicting Trump for admitting that he killed Soleimani, their commander. I mean, he's openly saying, bragging about
right, right.
And so they indicted him, and they asked Interpol to arrest, you know, pick up Trump.
Yeah, excellent.
Interpol said no, but the same day Interpol said no, what they did do was they arrested someone coming from Venezuela to Iran to negotiate a food deal. The guy was one who worked on the CLAP program, which is a program, another great Venezuela program, that basic food and kitchen essentials to 10 million Venezuelan households each month. And the United States had him arrested.
Arrested and Interpol cooperated.
And Interpol did that one.
And this is, of course, this is the campaign against the Venezuelan revolution has been very international. I mean, the United Kingdom has been very involved as well with stealing billions of dollars from the rightful money that owned by the government of Venezuela. And then
they took gold. Yeah. Bank of England has
right.
over $1 billion of gold of Venezuela. And Venezuela is now suing to try to get it back, but they've refused to give it back to Venezuela.
As they are facing all the crises they're facing in Venezuela, and then the UK and the US is withholding billions. And yeah, can you talk about what's the latest on the occupation of the Venezuelan embassy? I didn't realize until I was just catching up on recent events related to you that the jury was told that Juan Guaido was the president of Venezuela.
We were in a coup courtroom. And in the coup courtroom, we were not allowed to tell the truth that President Maduro was president because we had permission to be in the embassy from Maduro and his foreign ministry. So we were not really occupying it. We were there with permission. And we, for the first month, we could go in and out with no problem. But then the crazy coup mob came, surrounded the embassy, put us under siege, stopped food from being delivered, attacked people who were supporting us. It's got really a horrible situation. We ended up getting prosecuted. There were up more than 70 people in the embassy at the peak, sleeping over. We had more than 100 people coming in every night for concerts, for educational forums on AFRICOM, on Julian Assange, on Venezuela, on Honduras. And we had people coming in and out, no problem. But then that siege happened, and we ended up going down to 4 people after they turned off our electricity, turned off our water. We were able to get food in through various amazing struggles. People supporting us on the outside we were just incredible fights to get food in. And so we were, the final 4 of us were there. So we were ready to stay for another month or two, the government decided to come in and arrest us. They sent more than 100 police, many in military gear, battering ram to the door, broke into the embassy illegally, even though we said we wouldn't resist. And we had come down to talk to the police 2 days before that, right to the front door. They didn't arrest us then, but they used a battering ram to get in, came and arrested us. We were prosecuted with federal charges, the 4 of us. And in that coup courtroom, the judge ordered that we could not say Maduro was president. They had to tell the jury that Juan Guaido was president. He's never served a nanosecond as president. They had to say that the fake ambassador, Carlos Vecchio, a former oil executive who's wanted for the violent protests that killed scores of people in Venezuela. He can't even come back to Venezuela. He's the ambassador in that courtroom. But even with all that warping of reality, the jury would not convict us. We were able, and we didn't even testify, just through the cross-examination of their witnesses, we were able to show the contradictions. And I'll just mention 2 examples. One, we had a lawyer, Amara Verhaden Hilliard, for the Partnership of Civil Justice, who negotiated with the police and the State Department for us. When anything came up, she would be kind of one of the go-betweens. I would talk to them as well. I had their cell phone numbers. We'd talk on the phone. We were in the embassy, and our lawyer was talking. Why do they have a lawyer? It's so weird. And then another moment was we went out of the embassy to talk to the police, and prior to us going out there, they had been ordered by the fake ambassador to remove us. So we go out after that, talk to the police, give them our cell phone numbers. We get their cell phone numbers and we go back in the embassy. And the jury's like, why didn't why were they allowed to go back in? Makes no sense. So they were like, the jury was
so confusing, huh? For them.
So
if they have a brain. That's so confusing.
Yes. Going on. And it was interesting. We got to talk to the jury afterwards. The judge allowed the jury to stay for questions. Here, half the jury stayed. And they totally said we're confused. We didn't know what happened. And when we talked to the jury for Margaret Flowers, my partner, talked to the jury forewoman in the hallway, and she had voted to convict us. That when Margaret in less than a minute told her what was really going on, she said, oh my God, I would have acquitted you immediately. I had no idea that was what was going on.
Right? It's incredible. Yeah. Really, you really see
how political trials are manipulated in these courtrooms. I mean,
was this a grand jury, or was it called a grand jury?
A jury. This is a
just a regular jury. Because I mean, grand juries are a scary invention that the people. I mean, you would know well in your particular profession, professional training, just how horrible grand juries are. But people have no idea that these are not juries as juries.
I applaud Chelsea Manning for standing up to the grand jury in the WikiLeaks investigation. Mm. And she made a point about the grand jury being a manipulation tool for prosecutors. And, you know, if people don't know, the grand jury only hears from the prosecutor. They don't hear from the target. They don't have the target of the grand jury does not have a lawyer in the room. Witnesses don't have a lawyer in the room with them. And so it's like they only hear the prosecution version of what, you know, their version of reality, which is often false. And so grand juries, as they say, could convict a ham sandwich, could indict a ham. That's the thing.
That's the saying. It's more like the Inquisition than a jury trial.
You know, it started out, the purpose of the grand jury was to protect people who were being investigated. So it's a secret meeting. We're not going to mention the person's name. We're not, you know, it's that they don't get branded a criminal unless they're indicted. But it's been warped into this Inquisition instead. They've turned the purpose of the grand jury on its head, and now it becomes an Inquisition tool for prosecutors.
Kevin, the when you were a central organizer of the Occupation and Freedom Plaza in DC, which was an amazing ongoing event for quite a while in 2011, right? And into 2012 or 2011. And yeah. I think, you know, it seems like certainly with Occupy Wall Street, the taking and holding of public space as a center for organizing activity was a important aspect of the whole thing. And that's not a new idea. And it's happening more and more around the country with the current wave of protests. And I wonder just what thoughts do you have on the importance of that particular tactic?
Oh, lots of thoughts. But first of all, I'll say that when you occupy public space, you occupy the public dialogue.
Right.
It gives you an opportunity to take your message. And you can see both in the recent New York Occupy City Hall and the recent occupation up in Seattle. You can see how they put forward agendas and that got debated and got discussed. They would not, in our corporate media world, it's too easy to ignore people who are doing the real work that needs to be done to save our country from the plutocracy that's robbing it, and the corrupt two-party politics that's destroying it. So occupying public space is key. When we did the occupation in Washington, D.C., we worked on that from about, almost the whole year, from January to October, organizing it. You know, we had meetings with each week, 50 people on conference calls for months. Mm-hmm. We had a second group of conference calls, 50 people also organizing in various states. So this was not just like a happenstance thing. And then when Occupy Wall Street was first thought about, and that came out from July. So we had been organized since January. It started in July. It came out as an idea. They started organizing in August. We went up there to see what they were doing, see what we could do to help, and we coordinated with them. They started a couple weeks before us. Our guess that was what was going to happen was the police would stop them. You know, instead they stayed for months. And then the people would come down to D.C., we'd have a second occupation. So that was the idea of a rolling approach. Instead, what happened was the police showed their abusive personality and tear gassed some women who were already under arrest and behind an orange mess curtain. They just went up and tear-gassed them in the face. And that created an uproar. And suddenly there were hundreds of occupies starting. Then they did another mass arrest where they tricked people on the Brooklyn Bridge, corralled them, and they couldn't escape. They got arrested hundreds of people. And that made more occupations around the country. And so by the time we got to our occupation, even we started planning it in January, there were about 1,000 occupations. And we were the last ones to actually start. It was so interesting.
It was.
The history of occupies are so, I think one of the most important ones is the Bonus March, which was in 1932, the presidential election summer between Hoover and FDR. And the Bonus Marchers were World War I veterans who were promised a bonus. It was going to be a retirement bonus, and they wanted to move it up with the Depression. They wanted to move it up. So they went to Washington to ask for the bonus to be given to them now because it was the Depression. And they started to agitate for it and ended up being 25,000 veterans, 50,000 people totally with their families and allies occupying Washington in the middle of a presidential election. And the House passed the bill the veterans wanted. The Senate said no. And Hoover said no, and the veterans said, we're staying. And they did some amazing, it's a beautiful history. It's some amazing protests. I just thought there's so many I could go
on. Are there any particular highlights from that protest? Because, what is mostly known, if anybody knows anything about the Bonus March, they know that it was the first use of tanks that the U.S. military, the first time I believe the U.S. military ever employed a tank to do anything. And it was to burn down their
tear gas.
Tear gas. They pioneered tear gas.
They used tear gas against veterans.
Yeah. Veterans of a war where so many of the people in that war died from inhaling poison gas.
Exactly. And so you had Hoover got fed up with them at a certain point. And so he ordered Douglas Smith Arthur, George Patton, and Dwight Eisenhower to attack the veterans in the middle of a presidential election. They used tear gas, they used bayonets, they used cavalry on horseback, they used tanks, and there were people killed by tear gas, two infants and two adults. Another person was killed by a bayonet. I mean, and this was in the middle of a presidential election. This is why FDR won a landslide. And, in many respects, you can look at today and see Trump's reaction to the uprising. Tear gas, using the military to go make his little Bible, hold the Bible upside down appearance across in Lafayette Park, and look at the polls. Since he did that, he's been dropping. It's a repeat, the occupation of the Bonus Marchers and the uprising against the police violence and the reaction of the Trump versus reaction of Hoover. He's making the same mistakes over again. So that was just amazing.
It's fascinating, isn't it? But then this time, of course, history does, it may rhyme, but it may not repeat. And this time, it could be that this is laying the stage for a Biden landslide, which is a bit of a horrifying thought, really. But then there's the prospect of just no election at all.
People should know they're both scary.
They're both scary. I completely agree. But then what, for anybody that's been living under the past 4 years of Trump, especially if they're young and maybe they don't, I don't know, just bear in mind, people out there, that it was the night before Trump told his military to bomb an airstrip in Syria, Hillary Clinton was giving a speech in New York City where she is recorded on tape advocating for the bombing of every airstrip in Syria. Yep. So if that's any indication of the difference, everybody's saying, that Trump's going to start a war to distract from the situation in so many ways. And presidents do that. There's lots of precedent there. But we don't know whether he's going to do that. We don't know whether Biden would do that either. But I don't know. But do you think there's going to be an election in November? Way too early, but you think, we're not going to have a martial law and fascism.
It's very interesting. I think that the same incident in Lafayette Park where they used tear gas and National Guard, and Trump said he's going to call the military. Then you got a reaction from the generals saying, well, no, the military is not getting involved in this. You're not calling the military to do domestic enforcement. We're opposed to that. And you had retired generals, celebrity generals, Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, all saying no. You had enlisted people, I'm not going to do that. I mean, so I think that if that was an indication for Trump that he can't get the military to that kind of dirty work, they just, there's no way they're going to support ending, not having elections. So I don't fear that. I fear more the manipulation of the election. I fear the, you know, keeping people from voting. The COVID crisis may lower turnout. The lack of excitement about Joe Biden may lower turnout.
The collapse of the Postal Service, perhaps.
Right. The Postal Service. There are lots of problems in the upcoming election. But right now, the polls are really showing a historic landslide against Trump. And, as far as the fear of fascism goes, I'll again, back to that bonus march, I'll just tell you one more thing. Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine in U.S. history, spoke at the bonus march. And urged them to keep going. Don't give up. You're patriotic Americans. 2 years later, when FDR is arrested,
elected.
FDR elected. He's contacted by Wall Street bankers to be the U.S. Mussolini.
Wow.
He goes along with it just to gather information. And then he gets a reporter to come to meetings with him. So it's not just him saying it. He has a witness, a journalist. And so it turns out that a lot of financial interests, General Motors, DuPont Company, were all behind this business plot to make Butler the Secretary General of the United States and FDR a figurehead, because they thought FDR was going socialist. And a lot of these same people were behind efforts with Mussolini and with Hitler, too. Same company, same corporations. And this business, and F. So Sned goes along with it, and then he decides to blow the whistle and has a press conference. He has his journalist friend as well as a witness who went to some of the meetings so he could report on it. There were hearings of the Senate and the House together, joint hearings. They held hearings and concluded that Butler saved the country from fascism. And that doesn't get reported anywhere.
I have never heard of that. And I love Smedley Butler and his pamphlet. Everybody should read that pamphlet, but I had never heard about his almost being, if he wasn't such a great guy, that he could have been the next Mussolini.
And the business plotters were trying to decide between General MacArthur and Butler.
Good. They chose Butler.
And Butler was like a celebrity general. He had been on Time magazine covers. He won 2 Congressional Medals of Honor. You know, he's a very interesting character in history. He wrote that pamphlet, War is a Racket. He became an anti-war pacifist. He was opposed to World War II, U.S. World War II. That's what that was about, War is a Racket, where the people pay and the profiteers profit. Talking about fascism, that was a real effort and it was interesting. I started to really learn about that in depth during the time when the last financial crisis hit. And Obama was bailing out all these big business interests. The same business interests that were behind that fascist plot were getting bailed out by Obama. General Motors, all the hedge funders, the Wall Street banks. You know, wow. They didn't win the fascist plot, but they sure did put in place corporatocracy where they're in control of the government. And Joe Biden is the perfect example of that. He is Mr.
Perfect.
Good President, K Street, Wall Street. That's where he gets the health insurance industry. That's where he gets his support from. That's what he'll represent.
And he's from a small state, which is basically like the Cayman Islands of domestic U.S., along with Rhode Island. And
Delaware is where a lot of corporations incorporate because the rules are so loose. So he is basically the man from the court, from the MBNA.
So we're talking with Kevin Zeese on Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, Wednesday through Friday every week, along with other broadcasts I host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. All of these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix, on Patreon at patreon.com/davidrovix, and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. Kevin, when you were one of the folks on the ground floor, I'd say if you could put, I mean, it wasn't necessarily a new idea, but it was becoming more of a thing that was at least being talked about with drug legalization and mass incarceration, which took decades before some drugs got legalized. But back in the 80s, you were very much involved with all that, and that seems especially relevant today as we're talking about defunding the police and as we're talking about the mass incarceration, continuing to talk about mass incarceration, but it's been talked about a lot more in recent years than it was being talked about back then, is my impression. Maybe since Michelle Alexander's book, I don't know.
Right. I got involved in that when I was in law school at George Washington. I wanted to be a criminal defense lawyer, and the professor in charge of internships hooked me up with NORML, the National Organization for Reform Marijuana Laws. And my first job there as an intern was responding to prisoner letters and families of prisoners. And very quickly, it became clear the injustice of the drug war, the marijuana war. It became clear the racist nature of marijuana enforcement and incarceration. And so I got involved and became chief counsel of NORML and then its national director, and then later on, practiced law for a little while, and then also formed a group called Drug Policy Foundation, which became the largest drug policy group. When we were doing NORML, we were getting death threats.
Wow.
For advocating legalization of marijuana. That's how far we've come.
Because it was so threatening to people that wanted to maintain the racist power structure? Or what were the death threats about?
Well, I think, is the Just Say No era of Reagan and Nancy, who were making this a big issue for them. They were generating a lot of anger in their base about marijuana. And so there's a lot of false fears. Joe Biden still, by the way, believes that marijuana leads to harder drugs. The opposite is true, actually. Marijuana prevents people from going to harder drugs. But he's just warped on that.
Right. But,
so we were getting death threats. In fact, there were about, I think we had 15% support in the polls for marijuana legalization. I think there are more people who believe that Elvis Presley was alive than supported marijuana legalization. And now we are at 65% support for legal adult use, 85% for medical marijuana. We're seeing the drug war toned down. It has a long way to go to get corrected. It's still doing a lot of damage, but it really shows that change can happen. And something that seemed was a third rail issue that politicians wouldn't touch. Bill Clinton, as I said, turned me off when he put a general in charge of the drug war. Democrats were out hawking the Republicans with mandatory sentencing. Biden was pushing Reagan to be harsher on drugs than he already was. It was a bipartisan third rail issue. You could not talk about sensible drug policy. But a lot of people came together from different angles, some who were impacted by mandatory sentencing, some who were impacted by forfeiture laws that allow police to take your property without being any kind of conviction. Some people who are concerned about the Colombian drug war in the military, others, environmentalists, concerned about using herbicides to destroy marijuana. We had litigation on that. So people came from different angles, and a movement got created that got strong and became strong enough. And then it started to attract some people who were wealthy, who said, makes no sense. And they started to fund voter initiatives. When you can't get something through legislature, going around them, as a lot of Western states especially have initiative processes where you can collect signatures, put something on the ballot. That's how we broke through the barrier. It was first a proposition at the city level in San Francisco, Proposition P. I'm sure it wasn't because of pot. That's just coincidence. And that was followed by Proposition 215 statewide. And then other states followed, and we started to win medical marijuana initiatives, and then we evolved into legal adult use initiatives. And so now we're, I think, making tremendous progress on marijuana. I'll tell you, one of the great experiences I had was, though, to go into a medical marijuana dispensary, legal, in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
I've done this forever. And to go into a dispensary and you see this beautiful marijuana, displayed professionally, people are in line like in a bank line, weaving through the the line, and then I went to the back end and saw how they handled the marijuana, how they tested the marijuana, the care they took to do it. It was just like so great to see change can actually happen on these big issues that seemed like they were impossible. So That was just one victory, but over the years we've had many victories. I think another great one was stopping Obama in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, largest trade deal in history, would have made NAFTA look like nothing. And Obama pushed it and pushed it and pushed it. It was being done in secret. 600 corporations were advising Obama's trade representative about how to do it, but it was a secret.
Yeah.
In fact, the trade representative was finally asked, why is it secret? And he said, because if people knew about it, they wouldn't support it.
That's very democratic.
Yeah. We did an incredible protest with that. We worked with people who've been involved in trade issues. We brought labor, environmental, healthcare, pharmaceutical, workers, all sorts of, everyone was affected by this. It would have impacted everything. So it was a movement of movements moment. And 6-year campaign, and we successfully stopped it. Now, and I'm saying we, I'm not saying me, myself, I'm saying the movement. I don't do anything by myself.
So yeah, of course.
We stopped it. I'm not taking credit. I'm saying the movement stopped.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but sort of anticlimactically, Trump also withdrew interest in the whole thing, right? I mean, we were having amazing protests in Europe around TTIP. You know, that was, it was just huge there. It was really true. Germany, especially, and Belgium. I mean, Belgium is, you know, a small country, 11 million people. You had hundreds of thousands of people coming out protesting that. Exactly. Same in Germany, hundreds of thousands in multiple at the same time, hundreds of thousands in different cities across the country.
That's right. That's what's interesting about movements is that movements do all this work to make the change. And when the change happens, Trump takes credit for it.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
And that's the third party history, right? People understand what to do in 2020 when you have a terrible choice of Biden and Trump. The history of, we've always had a problem in the United States of two parties that represent big business. And that's always been a problem. In the slavery era, the Whigs and the Democrats had slavery was not allowed to be discussed in Congress. You could not discuss abolitionist slavery. It was off the agenda. You couldn't, it was taboo. And so even though there had been an abolition movement since before the founding of the country, in fact, the same year we became a nation, Vermont abolished slavery. So it was a long movement, but it was being blocked. And so people started to run for office in the 1940s. Third party candidates, various abolition parties. You know what they're called? Spoilers.
In the 1840s?
1840s and 50s. Mm. They're called spoilers.
Yeah. That's not a new term then, huh?
The Whigs and the Democrats, between them, Democrats were the pro-Mexican War Party and the Whigs were the anti-Mexican War Party, but they both supported slavery. And so abolitionists allegedly took votes from the Whigs and the greater evil Democrats got elected.
And the question with invading Mexico for those who are not familiar with the history was the question of, do we need, in order to preserve slavery, do we need to conquer this country that has just abolished slavery or not? And that was the debate, right?
Three excuses.
Yeah.
Exactly. As well as manifest destiny. But what happens in the end is, the Whigs and Democrats start to fracture over slavery. And then Lincoln, who was a Whig, joins the Republican Party, runs for office. He wins a 4-way race, the most successful third party president in history. In fact, the only third party president in history, 38% of the vote, 4-way race. There were two Democratic parties in the race, the Southern Democrats and the Democrats. And then there's the Constitution problem, which was the party that took the place of the Whigs. They were the remnants of the Whigs. And Lincoln won at 38%. So that's the only time in history, though, that movements and electoral politics actually resulted in a victory and a win. The more common experience is movements and third parties come together on issues. The third party candidate puts the issue on the national agenda, loses the election, but the issue wins. That includes the 8-hour workday. That includes ending child labor, union rights, trust busting, breaking up monopolies, ending alcohol prohibition, women's voting rights, civil rights issues for Black people. The whole New Deal came from the populist, the progressive and socialist party platforms. Threat of third parties running against FDR that pushed him from being a deficit hawk to the New Deal. So parties don't win elections, but they win the issues. you know, we
just like popular movements as well. They may be beaten by police, and
the two together. If you look at the Hawkins campaign, if you update HollyHawkins.us, look at the updates page, you'll see he's tied to the movements constantly on every issue. And so that's like the key is movements. And so that's what we should do in 2020, in my view. And especially in this year, because you look at the polls, 9 out of 10 states are safe states. We already know because the Biden has a 7-point lead or more in 9 out of 10 states. So we already know how it's going to turn out, where the electoral college votes are going to go. So why waste your vote on Biden if you know he's going to win anyway? So vote for what you believe in. If we can build up that third party support, that makes us able to pressure Biden and makes us able to build the third party. So if we get 5% in the polls, which is very hard to do in this manipulated, you know, mirage democracy, then we get matching funds, general election matching funds, which totally changes the game. But that only happens if people have the courage to vote what they believe in. So the 2020 election is a chance to put the movement into the electoral system. So we are, because we need to have these kind of uprising going on, not just now, but through the election and into the next presidency. The next president has to come in with an ungovernable country because the people are rising up. And that's what we have to be building toward in 2020.
Yeah, very good perspective. And how is efforts at campaigning going under the circumstances of the pandemic for Howie Hawkins? Because, I mean, not that any of the Green Party candidates ever get much attention by the corporate and so-called public media, but I'm hearing less about Howie Hawkins for sure than I heard about Jill Stein or Ralph Nader. Maybe he's
only become the presumptive nominee in the last week or 10 days.
Oh, that's right. The conference, I forgot, I'm singing at the Green Party convention next weekend, so it hasn't happened yet, right? So that's when he's officially becoming a candidate.
He became the presumptive nominee about 10 days ago, and so he has enough votes to win a first ballot nomination. There are about 6 people running, so we're glad. He worked very hard to achieve that. He's gotten a lot of good press even during that time. We're very lucky these days that the corporate media is not the whole game. Cable TV news doesn't get as much attention as it used to get. Now there are all these podcasts that have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of viewers. I mean, lots of people. You have places like Hill TV Rising, which are kind of a right-left co-hosting team. The left person is a former Sanders supporter. She has not endorsed Biden yet. And so that's an interesting venue. So we're getting those. And we just had a fantastic article in The Independent. Really great article. You can see all this on the Howie Hawkins press page, HowieHawkins.us. So he's starting to get press. I think that's going to pick up even more once he gets the actual nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was not Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader came in as Ralph Nader.
You know? So, right. So he was already quite well known from.
And Jill Stein, if you compare Jill Stein's first election in 2012, how he's doing comparable. 2016, she was running a second time. And was a known name, and so she got more attention. And she wasn't really challenged in the re-election, so she was the presumptive nominee from the beginning. So it's very different the last election she did, but it's more consistent with the first election. So he's a hard worker. He's deep on the issues. He's a working class guy. He's a Teamster, retired Teamster. He's a socialist, lifelong socialist. He also has the Socialist Party nomination. He picked Angela Walker, fantastic vice president. African-American woman from South Carolina, working class also, union member. She was the Socialist Party nominee in 2016 for vice president. She is a brilliant star. And so that you have two working class socialists running for the presidency and vice presidency this year. It's a really great team. We're very lucky to have them.
Have they been doing any traveling and that sort of thing? Or they're all like most other people staying at home or?
Howie traveled a lot before COVID. I mean, he went to every small Green Party meeting just to get the nomination. He worked really hard and drove mostly was driving. But since COVID, he's been mostly campaigning like you are here online.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's working all right. He's getting his message out. We hope that it changes. He misses the road. He likes to be with people. And Angela is great with people. But they both also have good presence when they're on video and doing live. They do a weekly live stream every Tuesday, the two of them. People can catch them there. And that's on Facebook and YouTube. And I believe on the Twitter live feed, Twitter has a live stream also. So it's on a variety of different systems. And so he's doing what he can. You know, it's always a challenge being a third party candidate because we live in a mirage democracy with manipulated elections. So we have an illusion of democracy, but not a real democracy. And so it's very hard in this country to really get an alternative voice in this very deeply embedded two-party system. It's really a two-party corporate dictatorship.
Yeah, because I mean, the one election you describe with Lincoln's election, I mean, the only reason that he was able to win was because the Democratic Party was divided, right?
And the Whigs were shrinking. And that took 20 years of abolitionists running and losing to get to that. Mm-hmm. You know, 20 years of hitting this issue that was so critical. You know, the westward expansion, slavery was an issue. The Mexican War, slavery was an issue. And so, you know, they were 20 years of abolitionist spoilers, you know, who spoiled the two parties, broke them both apart. And that's what Lincoln was the beneficiary of that.
Mm. And I like to say that it was maybe a slight oversimplification, but I like to say that the only time that the U.S. had a good government was those 2 years when the radical Republicans were in charge after Lincoln's assassination, when the 10 southern states were not able to vote. And then they still had to impeach the president, who wouldn't do anything that they were trying to do. It wouldn't enforce the laws they were passing.
Reconstruction was the missed opportunity.
Because there was only 2 years of the course of Reconstruction where there were real Reconstruction advocates in charge in the Congress, right? And then at that time, the president, Andrew Johnson, who had to be impeached, was against real Reconstruction.
That's right. So that was a moment that was missed. I mean, I think if we had that, we could have really dealt with the historic wrong of slavery and racism against Black people if Reconstruction had been allowed to continue. Instead, we got white terrorism in the South, the KKK and corrupt sheriffs working with them, and Black laws where people were arrested on vagrancy charges and forced to work for free. And, you know, so we, unfortunately, Reconstruction was reversed. It was the opportunity to really correct the historic wrongs. We have still not corrected those wrongs.
Vagrancy is such a charge. What a charge. Oh, vagrancy.
I know.
That is the charge of existing. And not being at home.
This is the historic wrongs of both the Black slavery and ethnic cleansing of the indigenous peoples are still two wrongs that have not been faced up to by the country and have not been corrected. We have to do a lot of really truth facing and put a lot of resources into correcting those terrible errors. I mean, it's just errors, the crimes. I mean, they're really crimes against humanity. If you read some of George Washington's writings about how to attack the indigenous people, he'd be a war criminal. Slaughter, destroy their tents, destroy their crops, kill their women and children, capture their men. It was vicious. That's his orders. You know, he's our hero, but he's really a war criminal. And he was also the biggest slaveholder in the country.
And Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz documents how important part of the actual economy scalps were.
Yes, you get paid for scalps. That's right.
Get paid quite well too.
Really ugly, very ugly. So we haven't faced that history. Mm. We haven't made up for it, and we're still, in fact, in urban areas around the country. As we started out this discussion talking about segregation and the destructive approach to not providing adequate resources to communities of color has led to an underclass that is policed, over-policed with mass arrests and mass incarceration. And that's what the uprising is about, really. It's about these bigger issues, these unfair wealth divide, the racist economy, the racist policing.
Now, what do you have to say, if anything, to all those many people that put the Black Lives Matter signs in their lawns, and a lot of them give me the feeling that I had back in 1992 when a lot of well-off store owners and white suburbanites were putting big guilty signs on their lawns. And I don't know how much attention they ever paid to issues of poverty and racism before that time, but suddenly they're worried about arson. And then they put up these signs. And although in other cases, I'm sure they're totally genuine, but it's just a very confusing pastiche, you know, because noticed going around town, if you put up anything about rent control, it's going to get taken down immediately. But put up a Black Lives Matter sign, nobody bothers it.
Well, you know, movements are so interesting because when a movement's winning, what you have is a small percentage of the population that's actually in the movement, but they are representing the interests, the national consensus on issues. We have a movement school on popular resistance. It's 8 web-based classes you can watch for free, a lot of reading materials. And we talk about how movements win. And what movements win is they're not a fringe movement. They become a movement that represents national consensus. And we are doing that on lots of issues right now. So we started this movement school before the uprising because we saw this coming. We saw these crises reaching peaks, and we saw the movements reaching stronger levels. And we needed to have people across the country educated on how to create social movements that win. And so when you see these Black Lives Matter signs in the suburbs, in fact, we had a really interesting experience in Baltimore. Margaret and I we were out provisioning for food and stuff. On the way back, we got stopped in traffic. And it turned out in this wealthy white neighborhood, they were doing Black Lives Matter protests, and it shut the street down.
All right.
So there we are. You know, people who shut streets down all the time. And we're stuck in traffic because they're shutting the street down on us.
Yeah, get out and join. I love it.
1,000 people out from this neighborhood on the street corners. There was also big downtown protests in Baltimore, but this was out in the – this is still Baltimore City, but it's closer to the edge of Baltimore County. But it was a wealthy white neighborhood, and Margaret and I are blocked by the protesters.
Wonderful. And in Baltimore and D.C., has there been much in the way of Occupy City Hall and that sort of strategy that they're employing?
You know, I think the Lafayette, that whole in D.C., that Black Lives Matter street now that our neoliberal mayor painted Black Lives Matter on, she got a lot of attention for it. There was an attempt to create a Occupy on that avenue.
That would be very appropriate.
And it was the same day that they tried to pull down the monument of Andrew Jackson. But in the afternoon, they were starting to put tents out and chairs out on Black Lives Matter Street, which is just across the street from the White House, Lafayette, the other side of Lafayette Park. And the police just immediately wouldn't let it happen. And then that same day was the effort to tear down the statue of the racist president, Andrew Jackson, who owned more than 90 slaves and sent the indigenous people on the Trail of Tears. And he's Donald Trump's favorite president. Trump put his picture in the Oval Office. And there was an effort to pull down his statue. And the police stopped him. But now 4 activists are facing federal felony charges for trying to pull that statue down. So we people need to come to support them because the statue issue is an important issue. A lot of people kind of mock it, but it's really important. The reason those statues are up, because the right wing saw Black power growing. They saw the early signs of the civil rights movement. They saw, Black, like the Tulsa massacre, where they saw Black population making its way economically. And so the Confederate, Daughters of the Confederacy and others put up these racist statues to Confederates. And so they knew the importance of that kind of messaging that white supremacy still rules.
Yeah.
Now it's important to pull those statues down to say, no, white supremacy is over. We're pulling down these symbols and hopefully get replaced with symbols that are representing a much more open and non-racist future society that we hope to build.
Yeah. On that note, Kevin Zeese, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. And thanks so much for joining me for the hour, which somehow is gone. I know it always does. It's like, these days, I mean, maybe if I did these shows at another time in history, an hour could seem long, but an hour never seems long these days.
Yeah, no, that's good. I appreciate it. We definitely got the topics I didn't expect to get into.
Oh, good. That's always good.
Yeah. And I'm really pleased, by the way, that you're doing this on Popular Resistance.
Oh, me too.
Thank you so much for doing that. And you know, I don't know if you know this, but first time I met you, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you were doing a house concert to raise money for Code Pink when they first came to Washington, D.C. And the house that they were doing the fundraiser in was my house.
Oh, wonderful. Great. That sounds very familiar, but
it's a long time ago, so I could be wrong. Yeah. 20 years ago. It could be,
you know, yeah. Yeah, there were some good house concerts. And was it in Washington, D.C. or Baltimore?
Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Around that time, I have vivid recollections of some great house concerts, but I don't know if it was that one or not. Great.
I think at that time when Medea said Dave Robux, I said, who's Dave Robux?
Good.
Anyway, I really appreciate you doing the work you're doing. I'm glad that you found a good use for your time when you're not on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. You too. Right. And see you around.
Okay. Take it easy.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. And thanks everybody for tuning in to this discussion with Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance, Press Secretary of Howie Hawkins' Green Party campaign for president, and many other things. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovix. My latest album, Notes from a Failed State, is now up on Spotify and all the other usual music streaming platforms. To celebrate, I'll be having a little one-man album release party this Saturday, July 4th, broadcast on whatever platform you're watching on, from here in my living room at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. GMT. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free. But if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my community-supported art program or CSA at davidrovix.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovix. Artists for Rent Control is now set up to start organizing an emergency eviction response team. Please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up. Tomorrow, I'll be joined once again by the founder of Liberation Road,